Hello there and welcome to our podcast, Conversations in Noosa. My name is John Caruso and the podcast is now available on Google Podcasts. My next guest has worked in film as a director and producer. He's been a journalist, broadcaster and businessman. His passion for radio wasn't simply a desire to work for a radio station. Brad Smart wanted to own the radio station. This podcast offers an interesting insight into what it was like for Brad to raise the capital, to purchase his own radio stations, and to streamline those operations so that they became profitable businesses. We also talk about the global financial crisis, two major floods, and a cyclone that impacted on Brad Smart's regional radio network. Whether you're someone who's worked in the radio industry, or maybe simply you're an entrepreneur or business person who's interested in strategy, risk mitigation, planning and business models, I do hope you enjoy this podcast.
I think for me, probably the golden days of radio were the 60s with the Rocky Jockeys that were first breaking out, because they say that the music that affects you and that you love for the rest of your life is that that happened in your teens. Well, I think the same sort of thing happens for radio. The days of radio being turntables and disc jockeys that were the good guys, and the days that probably influenced me. I remember Ward Austin in Sydney. I remember Phil Haldeman. In fact, when they had the Legends of Talk lunch that CRA staged about 10, 12 years ago, I got put on the table with Phil Haldeman. And I said to Phil, you know what really influenced me to go into radio? One day when I was 12 years old, I went up in the elevator at 2SM and I looked through just prior to 9 o'clock, looked through the big glass window there at Phil Haldeman playing the top 40 hits. And he sort of, well, that's a bit embarrassing, but nonetheless, it was true. You know, as a kid, I loved radio and always wanted to own radio stations. In fact, my parents took us over to near Swan Hill, a little town called Piangle, where my mother's sister was the postmaster. And on the way there, we stopped off at 2LF in Young, and I looked in through the outside glass windows at what was happening there in the Cowra studio. And then we got across and I went to 3SH in Swan Hill and looked through that. It was still in McCallum Street in those days, and I was just in awe. So I went home and calculated how much it had cost, and I think I calculated £1,200. But, you know, I was 12 years old. I'm probably a control freak. I want to own everything I touch. The idea of owning radio combined for me the creativity side and the business side. I've always been relatively creative. I was a news journalist in radio and television for about 10 years and wanted something more, so I moved out and became a film director. I followed that path all the way through, wanting to be creative. It wasn't a case of chasing money. It's the money comes if you produce the product. Well, I'll tell you a story of how I got into our first station. I got a bit frustrated as the commercial area of film production got a bit slow. And I said to my wife that we should look at buying a Mitre 10 store. And she said, well, you don't know anything about hardware. You love radio. Why don't you look at buying a radio station? So we looked at a couple had come up in South Australia, 5CC and 5CS. So I got the guy from the Commonwealth Bank to come over and said, look, I want to make an offer on these. So I did my figures and put the offer in. I thought it was a pretty good offer. It was,
what year are we talking about?
Oh, this is just prior to us buying 4VL, so it was probably about 1996-97, and I put the offer in. It was seven figures, and time went by, and I rang the guy up who was selling the stations. He was an accountant, and I said, what's going on? He said, oh, Mr. Smart, well, you didn't even get into the low category. I'm sorry. It ended up getting bought by Rural Press, and they paid $2.5 million or something for it, and I learned a lesson from that, not to underbid. Then 4VL, it wasn't for sale. It was the first station we purchased, but 4VL wasn't for sale. It was one you had to shake loose. And somebody said, I think 2WEB in Bourke, which was a community station that had bought 4VL, they probably would be happy to get out of it because they weren't doing particularly well with it. And so I went and had a talk to them, and made them an offer and they said, no, it's a bit low. Then I had an actual face-to-face meeting with them. After that, they came back and said, yes, okay, we'll sell to you. But it was only doing about $150,000 a year and had five employees.
In revenue.
In revenue, yeah. And that was not a terrific business proposition, as you could imagine, because salaries were still fairly high.
Your vision, though, Brad, to go in there and can you just talk me through the business side of structuring and setting that up?
It probably wasn't a very smart business move, but it was the passion coming through. What we were looking at doing was getting the first and then building on from there to have more stations, because the economies of scale just aren't. You can't live from one radio station. Not in those very, very small markets. I suppose if you own Triple M, you could, but not for 4VL in a market that size. And it was losing money. So I was still directing films, and I was using the revenue from that to prop up 4VL for a couple of years. But I came across a guy who lives here on the coast, Bob Harding. And Bob had been the general manager of ACES station in Horsham, and very smart guy as far as marketing and sales promotions go. It was he who came in, and because he had the experience in regional radio, I'd only ever been metro, and he was the one who came in and put us on the right path. And by 2007, 4VL had gone from $150,000 to nearly $500,000 in turnover each year.
So,
which was great.
Was it a balancing act in terms of employee numbers, network, localism? Can you tell me how you structured that? Did you have a full complement of day jocks and announcers across the day?
Well, when we took it over, it didn't have any computerization at all. It had a couple of announcers. I think it had three announcers and a news person and a salesperson.
And then networks overnight and dawns.
Yeah, it used to take Sky Radio and it'd be pulsed overnight. So somebody actually sat in the studio up until the time we bought it. We bought it on the Friday afternoon. On the Saturday, it was computerized. So we didn't waste any time. And that way we were able to use the people more effectively. And it was good fun. In those days, computerizing things with you had the music instead of the turntables running. It was running off computer. And it was better quality. And B, it was more convenient because you didn't have to have somebody in sitting in the studio all day long playing music.
But what contributed to that growth in revenue?
I think we showed the people in that Charleville license area that we were local. We had their interests at heart. We were responding to what they wanted programming-wise.
But how was that different to what they were already doing?
I think they would like to have been that, but they didn't have the right people in there at the time. We basically put the people, especially when Bob Harding came in, we got the people focused on what they should be doing.
And did that involve any networking at all then across the day, or was there still like a full complement of day announcers on board?
We did have networking, and one day I said to our computer guy who travelled up and down from Melbourne with me, because I was driving up and down to Charleville from Melbourne every month and staying there for a week and a half and then heading back down. I was exhausted all the time. But this guy came up with us, and I said to him one day, you know, we should get rid of networking. He said, why don't we do it tonight? So he restructured the automated programming so that we didn't take 2UE from that night. And that cut the costs dramatically.
What did you do?
He just programmed the computer to play
so
music.
So voice tracked across the night? Is that
well, there's no voice tracking. It was just basically back-to-back music plus ad breaks. One thing that was happening was the local advertisers were getting a heck of a lot of free ads. But that's part of that building the relationship with advertisers in those rural areas.
So you talked about economy of scale before. So then you had your eye on another station?
We always wanted to. We were looking at 4ZR and we were looking at anything else that was likely to come up, but it was all very tightly held. And Rob Gamble and Paul Thompson, of course, heading that up, but Rob Gamble was the general manager running all the DMG stations at the time. And I didn't know him at that stage. We'd love to have got hold of them. And the only solution we had was to go and look for what I'd heard were off-band stations that could be turned into commercial stations. And so we applied for, and we got 1611 licenses in Roma, Emerald, St. George, Gundawindi, and Roma. And eventually we set those up, all of them up, but we set the first one up in Dalby, and that was the foundation of the Hot Country Network. Now, we'd looked at the markets, and everybody was playing gold on AM and headbanging stuff on the FM stations. Now, we didn't have an FM at that stage, but we did introduce one at Charleville, and again, we went for the youth market with that. But people out there really love country music, and they love good country music like country rock. They don't necessarily want Johnny Horton playing, Battle of New Orleans or Sink the Bismarck, even in those days, and that's nearly 20 years ago. They wanted the current country rock that was playing. Australia was starting to embrace it, but America really had it.
Nashville, yeah.
Well, really, because the 90s was the revolution. That was the post-Garth era, the Garth Brooks era.
Yeah.
And that's when you had Shania Twain and Garth Brooks and Tim McGraw and Brad Paisley. They were all coming along in that era with some pretty good songs. And that's what these people were craving. So we set up Dalby, and it started to fire. Not dramatically, but it started to fire. And those stations were able to be converted to commercial stations under what they call Section 40 of the Broadcast Services Act. So we were one of the first to do that. And then the commercial radio people were pushing back against it. So the minister at the time said they all have to be on the air by the 31st of August 2004. And we were in the process then of setting up. During 2004, we were setting up this satellite network, which we did out of Charleville with 12 downlink points. They went in early August, and we put the other four remaining AM stations, which were 1611 and 1629, on the air by the 31st of August, and that became the Hot Country Network. From that point in 2004 until 2007, we built that to over an $800,000 turnover, which Janet Cameron, who's
Grant Broadcasters,
she said to me, "I don't know how you do it. It's with those off-band license stations." So we managed to do it, and it did very well, that station, because it resonated with the audience.
So what was your strategy then, Brad? Like a lot of business models, to build it up successfully and then sell it?
We really didn't want to sell it, but we knew we had to get bigger. You either is to get busy living or get busy dying, out of Shawshank Redemption. You've either got to get bigger or you're standing still and therefore you're going backwards. The opportunity finally came up to acquire other stations when Southern Cross, which was then RG Capital, bought out the Southern Cross operation with the television stations, and they had to get rid of a number of AM stations around Queensland.
Are these heritage stations like 4LM, Mount Isa, 4SB?
Yeah,
that's it.
Yeah, 4HI and Emerald, and finally 4ZR. So we managed to get hold of all those stations in the one hit, but our timing was pretty lousy. We ended up settling for them on the 1st of February 2008. 6 months before the global financial crisis started to bite. And that made it pretty tough.
Tell me how that impacted the regional communities where you operated. I mean, we know what happened on Wall Street and reverse mortgages and all that kind of stuff. But how did it kind of trickle out to those?
I don't think it really did. We were always getting positive feedback from people in the area. There wasn't that great problem. Oh. Our great problem came from the Commonwealth Bank. We'd borrowed over $5 million.
Oh, now I understand.
They also bought out the West Australian Bank, Bank West. At that time, they decided they didn't want to be in hotels. We saw all these hotels starting to go to the wall because of the increased interest rates. We were the only broadcast operation that they'd financed in quite some time. And I think they sort of got the idea that they didn't want to be in those sort of diverse areas. So they started to increase our interest rates. And they increased the interest rate from 6% in the end to 15.75 on $5 million, which made it very difficult to operate. But we kept going. Unfortunately, what we didn't realise, we were going to get 2 years of record floods in 2010, 2011. And it wasn't so much that the area got wet, it's what it did to the clients. Many of our clients had water flowing through their shops for weeks at a time. So they all had problems with their cash flow. They couldn't sell. And what we did, we went to those clients and we said to them, okay, we're going to leave you on air without you having to pay anything for it, because we want you to survive, because when you survive, we retain you as a client.
So what changes then did you have to make within each radio station? Were there job losses? What happened?
We held everybody on. We only had one announcer in each station, and we used each of those announcers around the network, and the rest of the people in each of the stations were salespeople generating revenue to keep the operation moving. It was pretty tough times.
It sounds
And when those floods came in, I remember in 2011, it was the record flood, once in 100 years or once in 200 years. It was the flood that knocked Brisbane out. But out in those western areas, we got hit in Roma, Charleville, St. George, in Kingaroy, and in Emerald. And I thought, oh, God, thank God, Mount Isa's been spared. And then Cyclone Yasi came through and knocked it all out. And most of its service area was cut off for up to 3 months.
Yeah. Was that the catalyst then for you to think about offloading those stations? Because that would have been very tough.
With the banks putting the thumbscrews on us, that basically put us out there to see what we could do. It was a very tough time to be operating.
Looking back now, Brad, would you do it again? Would you?
Oh, I loved it. Yeah, it was good fun. I don't think I'd do it now. I think it's become a whole lot tougher. The industry is probably regulated more than it was then. They've had this media reform, but it's not really media reform. It's very tough out there. They've got PPCA knocking on their door all the time for increased royalties. They've got APRA knocking on the door for increased royalties. There's a restructure now on the licensing fees. There's a lot of reports that have to be done. It's fairly onerous. Back in 2007, they introduced trigger events, which was if a station was sold, and of course all our stations were purchased after that date, so they were affected, you had to maintain the staff forever initially, and now it's down to 2 years. You had to maintain the same number of studios and other sorts of facilities.
Was this all to do with a percentage of local content?
It's all local. Yeah. It came down to local content as well, where a station under 30,000 audience, potential audience in the service area, has to do half an hour a day of local content, and those over that have to do 3 hours a day.
Apart from all the challenges you just mentioned, Brad, then, you know, there's the impact these days of the digital platforms as well and content on demand.
Look, I think radio is surviving pretty well. In the media pool, it's the darling at the moment. It's relatively low entry cost. The returns on investment are pretty good compared to television. Television, for example, is run by the accountants now and has been for 10 years. That's why I believe that they haven't been producing quality drama, that they now bitch about Netflix and Stan and Amazon coming into the market and taking their audience, because that's what the audience wants to see. What they want to produce are programs that they can produce today and can be on air in 6 weeks' time, not programs that you invest in today for quality drama and they won't go to air for 2.5 years. With radio, you don't really have that sort of problem. Radio is instantaneous programming. So you don't have to make those investments in long-term programming. So that's why I guess radio has become the darling of the media and is now being eyed off by some of those television networks to offset some of their, to add to their portfolios to make them more substantial organisations, particularly in the wake of media reform.
But I have a 9-year-old who has no concept of appointment setting. So he lives in an age, so I guess he's a millennial. He lives in an age of, on-demand content, whether that's a film or a song. And I'm concerned, I still love radio, I still, in this very room, still play around with the radio on a lot of the stations that you just mentioned. But I'm concerned that he, as this new generation of kids his age comes through, radio will be an alien concept to them.
I don't think so. I don't agree with that. What I think will happen, and it's definitely true, that they're an on-demand generation, and we're on-demand too. I mean, I use my Google Home to find songs I want to listen to, to find music I want to listen to. If I want to have company, or if I want to have entertainment supplied for me, I'll even get the Google Home to stream a radio station. That's what most of those smart speakers are doing now. 60% of the stuff that they handle is streaming commercial radio or radio in some form or other. That doesn't mean it's helpful to local radio, because I'll often listen to country music stations out of Chicago or Smooth out of the UK, or even a classic music station out of the UK. You're not necessarily listening to stations in your own service area, which is not good for them. But the majority of people are listening to radio on their car radios, at home. They're not deserting it in the numbers that the digital media would like to believe.
You mentioned the importance and the love and passion that people in regional Queensland have for this country format, and yet it hasn't really taken off successfully in larger provincial or metro markets. Is there a format that's missing somewhere on the radio landscape in Australia, Brad, in your opinion, when you think, oh, you know, that would be a great format and it's missing in this market or that market, or these guys should do this or that?
Well, we certainly did it. We looked at the areas in the regional, in those regional coverage areas, basically as their standard. AM operators would run gold and the FM would run that more progressive, either AC or urban AC, whatever it happened to be, whatever they thought their audience would want or the younger audience would want. We looked at it, we talked to people, and we found that country was missing. But it wasn't yokel country, it was progressive country. It was what had happened since the Garth era that we spoke about earlier. And that went very, very well. We did tracking surveys back in Roma after we got John Laws, because Southern Cross had dropped John Laws and had gone for Charles Woolley. And within 6 months, we tracked it, and we were the number one station in Roma. People will respond to niche programming if you provide the right niche programming for them. And we held that all the way through till we sold. We were getting 60 calls each morning to our breakfast show, which you don't normally get in regional radio stations. As far as a format goes that metro areas are missing, I guess they'd want to research it before they do anything. I've been critical of formats like Talking Lifestyle. I've been in print, and I've been critical also in print of Macquarie Sport, although they are giving it a go. I just think what they're doing is a bit ambitious. They perhaps should have retreated and held back on a music format for a while till they really worked out where they could have gone with that format. But there will be niche formats that come along, particularly in the digital area. Some sections of the industry call DAB dead and buried. I don't know whether it is. I think it does offer an opportunity to have a whole lot of niche formats out there. But nobody is monetizing it at the moment except for Coles Radio and other formats where an independent sponsor is getting a niche program for themselves. Seems to be how you can well, I guess it might be. It's the only way that seems to be monetizing the DAB area at the moment. I guess if they turn off AM and FM, then all the money, of course, would flow across to DAB in that case. But this country couldn't survive on DAB. We're too widespread. We're not Scandinavia. We're not the UK, where you can cover the country with a couple of big transmitters. DAB Plus, like FM, will basically travel that distance line of sight. We still need AM out here in some of these regional areas, even if it's only supplementing an FM in the main population areas, so that people aren't disenfranchised if they live out of those populated centres. DAB, I would think that they're going to have that niche offering for quite a while, but whether they're going to make any money out of it's another issue.
Brad Smart there. He was my guest today on Conversations in Noosa. Certainly enjoyed that. I hope you did. And a nice little insight into owning, operating regional radio stations across Queensland, and also how to deal with those challenges that arise from time to time. If you enjoyed the podcast, please rate and review the podcast on Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Stitcher or Wooshka, and please feel free to share it about on social media channels as well. There are two fresh conversations every week, every Monday and Thursday, up on our In Noosa Magazine website, innoosamagazine.com.au/conversations. Until next time.